come on a journey with a cinephile.
Wake up, sucker. We're thieves and we're bad guys. That's exactly what we are.
Welcome, listeners, to episode 230 of Journey with a Cinephile, a horror movie podcast. As always, I'm your tour guide here of David Garrett Jr., recording out of Columbus, Ohio. So in this episode here for you is going to be my Centennial Club number 16. This is going to be the last one that I'm doing for the year. And so my featured reviews here are Late Night with the Devil. Got to go see that one, like, the opening weekend and everything. So that'll be the 2024 release. And I'm pairing that up with Alita, the Queen of Mars. Doesn't make for the greatest double feature here, but what I can say is that we have, like, a normal-type world, but things that are might be, you know, a little bit supernatural underneath the surface for it. So then, for mini-reviews here, I got to go see Memories of Murder. I didn't know if this was going to be horror or not. I don't think that it is. I'll get into why, but I'm still going to do a mini-review. Then I have my Foray Through the Fours rewatches, It's Alive from 1974. Then I watch a documentary of 7852. Got to see a screener of Dagger. And then I also watch another movie from 1924. Wasn't sure if that was going to be horror or not. It's not, but I still wanted to give my recap of it, and it's He Who Gets Slapped. This is a Lon Chaney film. And then I have Godzilla X Kong, The New Empire. Get to see that in the theater, as well as doing another episode of The Walking Dead, The Ones Who Lived. So I don't think there's anything else I need to do here for this intro. So what I will say is thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoy coming on this journey with me.
Journey with a Cinephile.
And for my first mini-review, it's going to be brief, because this isn't a horror movie, but it's Memories of Murder. This goes by the original title of Selanui Chuek. This is directed by Bong Joon-ho. Now, he also co-wrote this with... I actually want to get this right, because there's a few other writers here on this one. The writers are Ho and Soo-bong Shim. And the play was written by Kwang Rim Kim. This stars Song Kang-ho, Kim Jang-kyung, and Kim Ro-ha. This is a crime, drama, mystery, thriller film that is from South Korea. Currently sitting on an 8.1 on IMDb and a 4.4 on Letterboxd with a synopsis being, in a small Korean province in 1986, two detectives struggle with the case of multiple young women being found raped and murdered by an unknown culprit. So this movie that I learned about through podcasts, it went on a list to see, especially after seeing director and co-writer's film of Parasite. This had such good filmmaking and writing that I was intrigued to see his other works. It didn't hurt that this earlier film is held in high regard. So my theater was showing this, so that helped. I got to see it on the big screen in 4K. So as the synopsis says, we're taking place in 1986. We have Detective Park Doo-man, portrayed by Kang-ho. Now, he shows up to a crime scene. It's in the middle of a field. There is a drain for rain and excess water. It has a cement structure. Inside of it's a woman who's been raped and murdered. There's also another victim. Park is doing what he can to gather evidence, but since it's a small village, there isn't much to go on. It doesn't help that both times it was raining. So then Park collaborates with Detective Cho Young-ku, portrayed by Ro-ha, and their methods are questionable. So a Detective Seo Tae-yoon, portrayed by Sang-kyung, has shown up from Seoul. Now, he butts head with Park and how they do their jobs differently. It catches the attention of Sergeants Shin Dong-chul, portrayed by Song Jae-ho, and Ko Hee-bong, portrayed by Byun Hee-bong. So So the stress is as tensions mount as the killer doesn't leave evidence at the crime scenes, so they have little to go on. We see different leads and where it takes them. Ultimately, we see the growth of our two main detectives, the friction between them as they try to solve these crimes before it's too late. So I'll be honest, there's something here. This movie stressed me out. I was in my seat squirming when, you know, the world of this movie and it started to rain. That is when the killer strikes. It does well at setting up our killer has victims. Then he goes after women that we've already set up and we've learned about. There's a great move there. This is drawing inspiration from real murders that happened in Korea, but it's also being inspired from the play Come See Me and borrowing a bit from the graphic novel of From Hell. It is sad that this is drawing inspiration from real crimes, so that makes this heavier as well. So where I want to go then is that this is a police procedural film. Just wanted to make sure that I set that up. What I like is that we see how Park and Cho manage their investigations. It isn't always by the book, and word has gotten around. This creates problems for Shin and Ko because it brings reporters. When Seo shows up, he doesn't like the methods that they use. It could also cause mistrials or just arresting the wrong person. What is great, though, is as the stress mounts, Park and Seo shift positions. Park grows up as a detective where Seo sees how he is doing things isn't working. I thought this had some great things to use there. I don't know if the impact would be as powerful if the acting wasn't good, but Kang Ho as a Bong Joon-ho regular, I think that he has been in all three films that I've seen of his. Kang Ho does great as a detective who isn't great at his job. He thinks that he can figure things out by just staring at a suspect. I like that when Seol shows, he starts to see things that a detective from Seoul does, and it shifts what he does. Sang-kwo is good there. What I like is that this character is losing humanity as the stress mounts. Ro-ha was good as his loose cannon detective. I like Jae-ho and He-bong as the two different officers who are in charge during this investigation of the department. We also have Ko Si-hee as a lady police officer who shows up with and comes up with actually a lead. And I also say Ryu Tae-ho, Park No-sik, and Park Ha-lee are good as suspects. The acting is great across the board, so that helps here for sure. Now, what also helps is this is well made. The cinematography here is beautiful to capture the vibrant colors of the field. It also then shifts almost to monochromatic when we're in the police station or other investigation things. The editing helps to build tension, and that's great. This is over 2 hours long, but I was on the edge of my seat the deeper we got into the investigation. The effects were limited, but it also that type of movie. This isn't one that I can recommend to everybody. This is from South Korea, so I watch it with subtitles on. If that's an issue, this has heavy subject matter and not a happy ending. This is bleak, and it made me love this even more with how stressed I got. This is a great film. So I'm giving it the highest rating that I can after one watch of something. So my rating then for Memories of Murder is going to be a 9 out of 10, but this one definitely has the potential to be a 10 out of 10 if I give another viewing to this one, which I do plan to do at some point. And then my next mini review is going to be my Foray Through the Fours rewatch of It's Alive. This is from 1974, written and directed by Larry Cohen, stars John P. Ryan, Sharon Farrell, and Andrew Duggan. This is a horror sci-fi film that is from the United States, currently sitting on a 5.8 on IMDb and a 3.1 on Letterboxd, with our synopsis being, the Davises are expecting a baby, which turns out to be a monster with a nasty habit of killing people whenever it's scared. And it's easily scared. So this movie that I feel like my dad enjoyed, and I feel like it was, for whatever reason, I knew about this one. It existed well before I should have. I didn't see it, though, until after college. It would have been me seeking out movies like this, and I've only seen it once. Now I'm doing this as a rewatch, as I'm much more versed in Coen films, and I was kind of curious to see how this one would end up holding up. So I want to start is that this movie is smarter than people give it credit for. This seems like it's considered a creature feature that has a mutated baby as a killer, and it also goes into, like, body horror, but it is that, so don't get me wrong there. But this is an interesting commentary. Now, I've seen the documentary King Coen, so that could also influence my reading of this, but he used to devour films growing up, so he knew what worked, and he was also an expert in guerrilla filmmaking, so there's also that. So where I want to start then for my actual thoughts is that I connected this one more than I originally did. Jamie, my wife, and I have a daughter. Her birth story was traumatic, so seeing Lenore go through a difficult labor and what results hits me differently. Should say Lenore is the wife here being portrayed by Farrell, and then her husband is Frank portrayed by Ryan. Now, I didn't react like Frank did, but Mackenzie also didn't come out deformed. Bringing in the commentary here is what I think I should go to. Frank is a good father to Chris, and that is their son being portrayed by Daniel Holtzman. I like that Lenore brings up how he struggled at first, and he just didn't have a connection. Now, her fear is that's going to happen again. Frank is convinced it won't until they realize that the baby is a mutant. He then spearheads wanting to kill it, helping the professor and Lieutenant Perkins. And the professor is Andrew Duggan, and then the Lieutenant Perkins is James Dixon. I can't fault him, though. This creature has ruined his life. What is great, though, is a change in the character that happens in the climax. I don't particularly think that Ryan has a good performance. There's some realism to it, though, so that makes it work, and I want to credit that. Some more commentary to go into involves the doctors and the professor. There's an interesting conversation where Laura is accused of wanting to abort the child. Frank defends her, saying that all couples explore all options as they decide what to do. There is a hot issue still today, so it's interesting that a movie 50-plus years ago would be exploring it. There's also the issue of why the baby is the way that it is. There's talk about smog and pollution. Another expecting father at the hospital talks about a chemical where they were using it to kill cockroaches, and it causes them to mutate to become bigger, faster, and stronger. There's also a peek behind the curtain where the professor is offered a position with an executive being portrayed by Robert Emhart with the company. There's the fear that something has caused this mutation. We also get a stinger at the end where that makes me feel like it better for the parents that are hearing this. And the parents in the movie, that is. This information comes from a subtle reveal or just throwaway lines. It helps to deepen the movie for me. I think I'll bring in the baby itself. That will include filmmaking. This was done practically, so it doesn't always look real. I read up a bit that this was a life-size suit being worn by Rick Baker's wife. It was his then-girlfriend, I believe. There's forced perspective there, and I love that. They did well in keeping it to the shadows, where you only get glimpses. I'm a fan there to hide the seams. The look that we get is creepy. There's some, like, monstrous teeth and look. I'll credit the effects, framing, and cinematography there. Other than that, the soundtrack fit for what was needed. The scarier part is the sound design for the baby crying. It sounds human-like, but there's also a creature vibe to it. As that goes, I feel sorry for it, which credit to the filmmakers. All that's up then is acting. I've already said how I feel about Ryan. Farrell is good as his wife. I'm glad that we got a baseline, which is brief. She then goes crazy from postpartum hormones and the loss of her child. I like that this descends into madness, wanting to protect. The scary thing is that I get it. Duggan is good as, along with Dixon, as the two in charge of finding this infant before it is too late. Guy Stockwell is good as his minor role as Frank's boss. What I like there is that he seems like a friend until Frank is gone. When you see that capitalism at its finest, other than that, Holtzman is good as the son of Frank and Lenore. I'd also give credit here to William Wellman Jr., who is their friend of Charlie. He's good and helping them out. Emhard, I would also say that... Oh, Seamus Locke as the doctor. The rest of the cast were fine around the software was needed. In conclusion, this movie that stuck with me since childhood, despite not actually seeing it. Watching this now, where I'm at in life, it works better than I expected. I love the premise. It is something that people can connect with, then perverting it with a mutant baby. I love the social commentary you can pull from it. This is a well-made from the framing, cinematography, and practical effects and sound design. The cast also fits for what was needed. Not everyone will enjoy this as much as I did. This is up there with one of my favorite films from Coen. I'd recommend this if you want to see a bit different take on the creature feature film. So my rating for It's Alive from 1974 is a 7.5 out of 10. And then up next, I have a documentary, so I'll be kind of brief here on this one, but I have 7852. This is from 2017, directed and written by Alexander O. Philippi. This is starring Marley Renfro, Alfred Hitchcock, and Terry Caraba. This is a documentary surrounding Psycho, just so you're aware. And this is from the United States. Currently sitting on a 7.3 on IMDb and a 3.6 on Letterboxd, with a synopsis being an unprecedented look at the iconic shower scene in Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho from 60. The man behind the curtain and the screen murder that profoundly changed the course of world cinema. So this is a documentary that I heard about when it was released. I was going to check this out at the Gateway Film Center, but I couldn't make the schedule work. It went on a list of movies to check out, and I believe around then it was also covered on podcasts, or at least brought up. So now I'm seeing this documentary that was looking at the shower scene from Psycho. I remember seeing the movie growing up. It is one that I come back to periodically. I've seen it in the theater a couple times. I even owned it on 4K. There are elements of this scene that are just not just part of the zeitgeist, but like just in everything in general, and people who've never even seen this know about it. That would be how this scene has influenced cinema in general. The music going with it is known by people who have never seen it. Hitchcock is one of the greatest filmmakers of all time, and it is things like this sequence that cement that. What I didn't realize about the documentary is that we interview like the body double for that scene, Renfro. They also interview Hitchcock's daughter of Caraba, who gives insight that she has talking to him and her grandmother. There's some archive interviews of Hitchcock himself, and I believe the cinematography might also give some details. Should also include here, the title is the number of shots and cuts that it took to make this work. something I wasn't expecting were all the filmmakers, writers, and professors that get interviewed to help break the sequence down, as well as to talk about the impact that it has on filmmakers or just the industry in general. This includes like Richard Stanley, Elijah Wood, Bret Easton Ellis, Lee Whannell, Karen Kusama, Peter Bogdanovich, Scott Spiegel, Daniel Noah, Mick Garris, Eli Roth, and Marco Calavidia. That's just naming some of the people that appear here. There's an important individuals here who it just had so much of an impact on. So this is well made. I love the footage that they shot for this, being in black and white, paying homage to Hitchcock and Psycho. The array of people they have is great. This flies by. I was interested in hearing what each one had to say, how it influenced them, and what they've seen from the impact. This won't be for everybody. Hearing how they crafted the sequence is interesting. I'd say that if you're a fan of films and who wanted to just learn more, and if you enjoy behind the scenes or just how films can influence the work as well, this would also be for you. So my rating here for 7852 is going to be an 8 out of 10. Then next for you is a screener they got to watch. I think it's Dogger. This is from 2024, directed by Matthew Butler Hart, who wrote this with Tori Butler Hart. This stars Riz Moritz, Ellie Duckles, and Tori Butler Hart. This is a horror thriller film that is from the United Kingdom, currently sitting on an 8.4 on IMDb, and not enough ratings yet on Letterboxd, but I would say between like a 2 and a 3-star movie over there, with a synopsis being, fame-seeking YouTubers find themselves in a paranormal nightmare when the advert team that they are stealing from awakens a murderous occultist from the past. So this is a movie that I got the chance to see thanks to Kimmy from Studio Dome. Along with Shirley, they sent over the screener. The Horror Collective got this, and I've enjoyed what I've seen from them so far. I didn't read the blurb, but just making sure this was horror and seeing it was a 2020 release helps as well. I was able to, you know, come into this one blind outside of that. So where I want to start is saying that this is filmed in the style of found footage. We start this out learning about our, like, YouTubers who are Luis, portrayed by Moritz, and Thea, portrayed by Duckles. And they're using phones to film their content. Now, we also have Tori and her crew using a digital camera of sorts, and Tori is portrayed by Butler Hart. Now, something interesting was that while watching the credits, this whole thing was filmed on iPhones. Not the first time that I've seen this done, but I will say that it's always amazing to me to hear that and see that kind of information. So with that set up, we know from the beginning that this is edited together by professionals. They were able to obtain footage from the police, which that information was given in the beginning. We then meet Luis and Thea. They are your typical YouTubers. I'm guessing they'd fall into Gen Z. What I like about them is that they're against the rich. They don't think that they've had many struggles in their life, so it's a little bit misguided. But instead of working a normal job, they have their channel. Stealing from the rich to give to charity is a gray area, but I respect it as well. They're smart enough to edit their footage to prevent getting into trouble. It feels like Moritz and Duckles are old friends that adds realism. What I like is that they get under each other's skin, which feels normal, so credit to both of them. Then we have this other group of Tori, and then she is joined by her team of Gray, portrayed by Graham Butler, and Hattie, portrayed by Hattie Chapman. We see them arrive at the shooting location. Tori gets frustrated since they're supposed to send over the footage to someone to approve the location. It doesn't go through, so that's sort of a setback to start. Then it's just a series of them from there. We also have their on-screen talent is Matt, portrayed by Matt Barber, and Emma, portrayed by Emma King, and they're a bit high maintenance, which causes issues. I will say, though, everyone's acting here feels natural for what they needed to make this work as well. The last bit would be the supernatural. I like the little things that we get to help fill in the backstory. Luis and Thea stop off to get directions at a village. It is near the house that they're going to. It is there that they learn about the cult in the area. Luis even buys one of their masks, which is on the poster that I saw for the movie, which is creepy. We get images and scenes where footage that has been shot messes up and shows different things. There are hooded figures in it and maybe even a sacrifice. Inside of the house, a television turns on to show a Professor Ash Blake, portrayed by Luca Thompson. He came to this house to do research and let us know about a druid group here. Their leader was Lord Summerton. And he thought if he did certain rituals, it would give him eternal life. This is done in an info dump way, but I thought it worked for what was needed to drive this along. It would put this into folklore, which I'm always a sucker for. Now, where I'll end out would be filmmaking. I do like the found footage stuff. My issue is that others have. Would these people continue to film? A good thing here is that Tori's crew is filming for a purpose to send over to investors, and they're doing like B-roll while Thea and Luis show up. They set up their cameras to do their episodes. Again, they're also shooting B-roll. This duo I could see carrying a camera around like they do, since they seem like they film everything. There are also characters who flee into the darkness, so they needed their devices for light. Now, I like the editing. Tori's crew had already started filming, so I like that we fill in what we've missed by having this duo come in and watch it on an iPad. This leads them to getting caught up and trapped with them. Then for the effects, they are limited for the most part since we don't see a lot. The blood that we do looks good. I like the druid look. My issue is the digital messing up of the footage. This gets on my nerves, but it's used a lot here. There is something done with a druid appearing and disappearing in shots that's creepy to me. Other than that, I thought this was edited. You know, the edited footage, it makes sense there to be a soundtrack. The design also looks with creepy chanting and crows kind that adds atmosphere. In conclusion, I thought this was a solid found footage horror film. It isn't necessarily doing anything new. What I'll credit is that it's building a good atmosphere. The acting felt real enough. This is made well. I can believe why people are filming. I thought there were good things with editing, sound design, and effects. My only issue there is the digital messing up of footage that got on my nerves. This won't be for everybody, but I thought it was a tight little film that was creepy. Things here and there could have made this better, but not a bad watch by any stretch. So my rating here for Dagger is going to be a 7 out of 10. And I also believe at the time of listening to this, this should also be available on VOD. And another movie I got to check out, not necessarily a horror film, but I'll get into it here while I'm covering it, is He Who Gets Slapped. This is from 1924, directed by Victor Sjöström. I'm not sure how to pronounce some of those letters there, but he also helped with adapting this to the screen with Carrie Wilson, and this is from the play by Leonid Andreev, and then this is the titles were done by Marion Ansley. This is a drama romance thriller film that is from the United States, currently sitting on a 7.8 on IMDb and a 3.9 on Letterboxd, or Synopsis. A bitter clown endeavors to rescue the young woman he loves from the lecherous count who once betrayed him. So this film that I'd seen the poster for, I didn't know if I realized that it was starring Chaney until looking more into it. This popped up on my radar for 1924 when for a day it was listed as horror on Letterboxd. It is no longer there on the next day, actually, and still not. I decided that since it was there even for a minute like that I caught, I'd watch it to judge for myself. Now, having seen this, I don't think it's horror, but I can see why it's loosely considered. So we have Paul Beaumont, portrayed by Chaney, is a brilliant scientist. He has been taken in by Baron Ragnard, portrayed by Mark McDermott, to prove his theory about humanity. Paul is married to Marie, portrayed by Ruth King. What he doesn't realize is that the Baron has taken a liking to her, and they're having an affair. Paul proves his theory, and the Baron agrees to set up for him to prove this to the scientific council. There's a problem here, though. Baron Ragnard presents these as his own. When Paul demands to tell the council the truth, he's laughed at. He's then slapped by the Baron. Everyone, you know, starts laughing even harder. To make matters worse, Mary reveals the affair and leaves Paul, and he is then kicked out of the Baron's house. Paul then joins the circus as a clown. He goes by the name He Who Gets Slapped. His gimmick is that he will say things and get slapped by two clowns. This makes the crowd laugh. He is then the headliner for the circus. Now, Baron Ragnard and Marie mock the act, but the Baron does go to see it in person. Now, there's also a Count Mancini, portrayed by Tully Marshall, who gets his daughter Consuelo, portrayed by Norma Shearer, to join as a bareback horse rider. She works with Benzio, portrayed by John Gilbert, who falls in love with her, as does the Baron. Now, her father is trying to sell her off to him, which He Who Gets Slapped warns her about. He also sees his chance to get revenge on the Baron. So that's really my recap introduction to the story. What I want to say is that I can see why people consider this to be a horror film. As I said, I don't, but this goes to dark places. The drama is set up by the Baron stealing Paul's work and his wife. What is bleak here is that the story never gets resolved. Paul just sinks into depression and his outlet is to become He Who Gets Slapped and being laughed at on his way of coping. It is looking at trauma in the eye. Now, what we also have here is a redemption story for Paul. He sees the same thing playing out for him with Benzio, Consuelo, and Baron Ragnard. He Who Gets Slapped pours his heart out to Consuelo and she laughs at him. This made me feel bad, but what is good here is that he predicts everything that will happen with the Baron and her father. He Who Gets Slapped knows that she won't pick him over Benzino, but he does see a way to make her happy. It is here that things go dark again, where He Who Gets Slapped releases a line in a room when the Baron and the Count wasn't expecting that. Now, something to also give credit here is the acting. Chaney is great. I'm not seeing a bad performance from him. King isn't giving much to work with as Marie, but what she's here for is to be a mirror for Consuelo. That would make Paul and Benzano connected. Paul and Marie were young and in love, and then she was enticed by wealth. Count Mancini has lost their money, so his daughter must work, and he's trying to sell her to Baron Ragnard. The acting here was good across the board. Let's then finish out with filmmaking. The copy I saw on Tubi also helps as it was crisp. There were surreal shots that were interesting. We keep seeing Hugh get slapped spinning a globe. There is superimposing clowns along a rim, and then it shifts to be in a circus pit. That was interesting to see. Cinematography, other than that, was limited by technology, but still looks good. There isn't a lot in the way of effects, but that's also the era. I'm also not sure if the soundtrack that I had heard was originally synced up or not. There was a good touch with the design, though, with a laugh track when Paul or he who gets slapped is being mocked. That raised tension for me and made me feel bad. This is one that I'd recommend to fans of Chaney or silent film era cinema. I enjoyed my time here for sure. So my rating for He Who Gets Slapped after this first watch is going to be a 7 out of 10. Then my next mini review here is going to be the last feature that I cover, and that's Godzilla X Kong: The New Empire. This is from 2024, directed by Adam Wingard. Now, this is written amongst a lot of people here, so let me go ahead and get everything straight. Is that the screenplay is written amongst Terry Rossio, Simon Barrett, and Jeremy Slater. And the story is done by Rossio, Adam Wingard, and Simon Barrett. This stars Rebecca Hall, Brian Tyree Henry, and Dan Stevens. This is an action-adventure sci-fi thriller film. This is a kaiju film, if you didn't know. From the United States, currently sitting on a 6.7 on IMDb and a 3.0 on Letterboxd, or synopsis. Two ancient titans, Godzilla and Kong, clash in an epic battle as humans unravel their intertwined origins and connection to Skull Island's mysteries. So this is one that I heard about coming out. I wasn't overly excited. I'm not sure why, since these are fun. I look at these like comic book movies. My guess is that Godzilla Minus One blew me away, so I knew this was going to pale in comparison now. Regardless, I saw this opening Thursday at the Gateway Film Center. I had a list of movies to see for the weekend, and this one worked best for this day, and I could just, you know, knock it off that list there. So the best part of these, outside of the action and battle sequences, is the lore that they continue to build on. They have taken entities from religion and incorporate them as the being titans. This here would include like Tiamat and Shiva. Or they'll take conspiracy theories like Hollow Earth and use that as well. There are good things here that they borrow from with like earlier kaiju movies for story elements. I'm a fan there as well. I just wanted to give this information before I started delving deeper into them. So Ross, go then would be the new titans. I'd already said that they're good to build on with the previous movie set up. We know coming in that Hollow Earth is a thing for this world. King Kong knows that his species had called this world home, but he can't find them. There, he's continuing his search. This leads him to go deeper into the subterranean area that's unexplored. There's more legends to be explored there. We also have Kong's race as defenders of humanity. Godzilla's the defender of Earth. What is interesting here is that we learned about the Scar King, which is good. It also introduces Shiva, which I know from Hinduism. This also is more closely to like the Final Fantasy games, presenting this as like the God of Ice. This deity is supposed to be a rival of Godzilla, or at least that's kind of how they're presenting this here. There are more elements here of this tribe that lived on Skull Island. Also, Tiamat is a Mesopotamian goddess and appears in Final Fantasy games as well, normally as a villain. So then let's shift over to this last idea here. This plays with the idea that Kong is looking for others like him. He has no place. The same could be said for the character of Gia, portrayed by Kelly Hoddle. She's struggling in school. Then we have Eileen Andrews, who has adopted her, and she's portrayed by Hall. It's determined to make her feel welcome or find something that does. This brings heart to the movie that I appreciated. The idea is explored even more as we discover other giant apes and Gia's missing tribe. Though, also for the story is that I noticed that there's less commentary here about the environment. I'm fine with that. They went a bit heavy with the idea in the last couple movies. This focused more on Hollow Earth. This is also more about saving the world from destruction as well. I'd say that what we're seeing here is like we have this vet to help Titans. That's kind of a cool thing to play with here. He is Trapper, portrayed by Stevens. They're also dealing with the government to try to take over this program of Monarch. There's more of a passing idea with that. Something that stressed me out, though, was seeing these Titans destroy wonders of the world like the Colosseum or the Great Pyramids of Giza. I've seen the former, and knowing how breathtaking it is, so there's some realist part of me that got tense. So let's go over then to the kind of what the main event here would be, filmmaking. What we have here is CGI and effects first. These movies are working with high budget, so the effects are on point. I'll be honest, they look great, especially on the big screen. These movies are made for it. They're a CGI fest like the comic book movies. I still have fun with the fight sequences. They do wild things there. I love seeing Godzilla wreck things. Cinematography is good with how they frame and bring places that don't exist to life. That's good. The soundtrack also didn't seem to feature the iconic Godzilla theme, which is an issue for me. Although not the rest of the music work and the sound design to bring these characters to life. All that's left then is acting. Hall is fine here. She's a good actress, but her performance isn't a focus. I like her as a scientist wanting to help Kong and in turn the world. Henry adds comedy. He's also a smart guy about things that people don't believe in. I like the addition of Stevens. He's like a surfer guy who's just out to have a good time, but he's also smart in his field. Hoddle was solid in her role. She is featured prominently again, and that worked for what they did there. I'd also want to give credit here to Alex Ferns, as well as Fala Chen, and the rest of the cast rounded out for what was needed. Again, the kaijus are the focus here. No one is bad, though, which is all I ask. In conclusion, this is a fun popcorn movie. I include these in horror since I lump in kaiju films. This isn't traditional horror outside of that. What I will say is I love building more on the mythology of these creatures. Seeing them do battles of the draw, incorporating more titans is great. This is well made. They have a big budget here, so the CGI looks good. The framing and cinematography help to capture all of that, which is solid. Won't be for everybody, but if you want something to shut off your brain and roll with it, this one's for you. So my rating for Godzilla X Kong, The New Empire, is going to be a 7 out of 10. So the end up mini reviews here is going to be a review of the next The Ones Who Live, The Walking Dead thing, of What We Is This episode, number 4. This one was directed by Michael Slovis. And then this one is Rick and Michonne find themselves in the ruins of Greenwood. Despite Michonne's plea to return home with her, Rick is determined to complete Okafor's mission to reform the Civic Republic military into something better. So this one's kind of weird, is that Michonne is struggling with Rick, and he wants to go back with her, but he can't. He's worried that the CRM or whatever is going to kill everybody if he does. So they end up in this like modern house where there was this contained like group that was living here. And then we saw the helicopter like had crashed in a nearby building. So I'm assuming that in the storm they tried to turn around to go back, but they crashed. And we also see that another one appears, shoots missiles at that other helicopter, and this causes the building they're in to start to collapse. And this is done as like a cover-up. This is supposed to be an off-the-grid building where we have innovators, and it failed. An allegory to the CRM, this is what Michonne keeps throwing into Rick's face and everything. And by the end of this one, it does seem like he's agreeing to go back, so we finally have, you know, like the main crux of the story here. I'm still going to keep watching this one. I end up giving this one a 7.5 out of 10. So, like, we will see, as I'm already going to be moving into that next one, you know, as well. So, that's all I have then for mini reviews here. So, let me get you over to the trailer of my first featured review.
We are back in 5, 4. Now, here's Mr. Midnight, Jack Darrow.
Oh, good evening, Night Owls, and thank you for allowing me into your living rooms once again. Well, Night Owls, we've got a heck of a show in store for you tonight, and I'm very excited for you to see it all unfold before your very eyes. I really hope you love it. Gosh, I hope you love it. Please love it. Love it.
I'm trying to host a national syndicated talk show.
And I'm trying to help you keep it on the air.
We all know how important it is to keep our sponsors and affiliates happy, but in my humble opinion, there is only one person who really matters in this whole darn crazy business. And that is you, our viewer.
You're meddling with things you don't understand.
Whoa! Now, as you know, here on Night Owls, we think it's very important to keep an open mind. Please welcome Dr. June Ross Mitchell and Lily, the young subject of the book, Conversations with the Devil.
I really don't think it's a good idea, Jack. She's becoming more unpredictable.
That's a good thing. That's why we still do live TV.
Ladies and gentlemen, please stay tuned for a live television first as we attempt to commune with the devil.
Lily, can you hear me?
Good to see you again, Jack.
Lily, return to me.
This isn't about ratings anymore.
No one's going anywhere.
How could you let it happen, Jack? How could you let it happen?
Please be warned, anyone with young children in the room.
Go to commercial!
You're about to see...
You okay, Jack?
It's profoundly disturbing and shocking.
You get out there, Mr. Midnight. And you knock him dead.
And for my first featured review here is going to be Late Night with the Devil. This is from 2023. This is directed between Cameron Karnes and Colin Karnes, and they also wrote this together. Now, this is starring David Dalmatian, Laura Gordon, and Ian Bliss, while also featuring Faisal Bazzi, Ingrid Torelli, Reese Aturi, Josh Kogtart, Georgiana Haig, Steve Mozakis, Gabby Sowell, Christopher Kirby, Paula Andrudel, Mitchell Bratz, Nicole Chapman, Inman Haichi, Elise Jansen, and Chase Kaufman, while we have Michael Ironside as the narrator, which I didn't realize until I was actually settled on to write this. Then this is a horror film that is a co-production of Australia and the United Arab Emirates. This is sitting on a 7.5 on IMDb and a 3.6 on Letterboxd, with our synopsis being: a live television broadcast in 1977 goes horribly wrong, unleashing evil into the nation's living rooms. So this is one that I was excited for my horror releases for the year. Seeing that this featured Dolph Malshin, who is an actor who has been doing more in the horror genre as of late, that was a perk. Then hearing the buzz for this from film festivals was another. So this is one that I got to see during the opening weekend at the theater. So let's do some feature notes here, and I'll start with our directors. First is Cameron. He has directed three films, all in horror. This is the first that I've seen. He also did 100 Bloody Acres and Scare Campaign. Now, it looks like he works with his brother, Colin. They've done the same three films. And I should also go ahead and just say here, this duo also wrote this film, this the same three that they've directed. But we also have an assistant director of Andrew Power. This is their feature film debut. Then taking this over to the cast. I'll start with Dolph Malshin. He's done 46 films and 19 shorts. I've seen 13 of his stuff. Not in horror, I've seen Oppenheimer, The Dark Knight, Prisoners, along with the Ant-Man movies. In horror, he has 9. I've seen 5. I've seen Bird Box, The Boogeyman, Last Voyage of the Demeter, The Belko Experiment, and now this. I have not seen Horsemen, The Domestics, Dust Bunny, or The Boulay Brothers, Halfway to Halloween. His co-star of Gordon has 11 movies and 3 shorts. I've seen her in 2 things, both in genre, with Saw 5 in this. Has 4 in horror with Come Back to Me and Alien Strain, as the 2 that I haven't seen. Then also cover Bliss. He has 15 films, and I've seen 5 of them. I've seen Matrix Reloaded and its sequel, as well as Superman Returns. Then we have, well, see, Letterboxd actually doesn't consider Scary Movie as a horror film, and he was also in that. He has 2 technically in the genre, though, with this and Man-Thing, as I have not seen that latter one as of yet. So let's get into this movie here. How this is presented is a late-night talk show called Night Owls. The host is Jack Delroy, portrayed by Dolph Malshin. He is competing with the likes of Johnny Carson, which adds realism to this work. Jack is successful, and his show does well, but it's never the best. It keeps coming up short. We get to learn a bit more about his personal life. His wife and muse is Madeline, portrayed by Hegg. Jack takes a blow when she passes away from lung cancer. There's another darkness to him that he's a member of a secret organization like the Freemasons that are... they commune out in, like, California around the Redwoods and everything like that. And this actually kind of has a bit of a bearing on the movie itself. Now, the episode that we see is the beginning of Sweeps Week. It happened on Halloween. There's a theme with that. It starts with Christow, who is portrayed by Bozzy, who is a psychic. They're following it with Carmichael Hegg, portrayed by Bliss, who is a renowned debunker of the supernatural. The last guests are June Ross Mitchell, portrayed by Gordon, and Lily Diabo, portrayed by Torelli. The latter was a member of a satanic cult that survived their house burning down during a ritual, and, I mean, she survived it. She is the only a teenager, though. June is there to help. The movie does well in filling in Lily's backstory in the fashion of a documentary, and I mean, kind of what we're getting for the beginning with the main character of Jack, so they kind of just shift over to this and give you more of that information as it's leading up to meeting her. The original recording of this episode was thought to be lost. It was found and restored, along with other footage of backstage things. This also adds to the realism, making it a variation on found footage shooting style with that. Things start to get weird when Christow makes a strong connection that messes with electronics in the studio. It also makes him ill. Carmichael goes about proving him wrong. That is when Jack blindsides June to allow Lily to bring out the demon that possesses her. This will make for an episode of Night Owls that no one will ever forget. So let's leave my recap production of the characters. Where I want to start is that this does an excellent job in its setup. I did hear Duncan from the podcast Under the Stairs, his non-spoiler review, ahead of watching this, so I knew things coming in. I love this sets up the character of Jack. There are things about his personal life that we learn, like the organization he's a member of and what happened with his wife. Also, the setup to the show is good. Using real things like Johnny Carson, his show, and real events in the world bring realism to what is fantastical here. There's also vibes of Ghostwatch with the premise that we are using and things that happen as well. So where I'll then delve deeper is that this doesn't have the deepest story, but it doesn't need it either. This is more of a character study of Jack, Carmichael, and like June and Lily. Those around them are pushing things to where it ends up, but it's centered around this group. Now, I've already given aspects of Jack's history. This show is on the verge of being canceled. That causes him to push the envelope. This has good writing throughout things that get said or introduced coming into the play later. That is something I always appreciate. Dust Mulchin has the right amount of charisma to fit this role. So let's go over to the skeptic then of Carmichael. I wasn't expecting them to have a character like this, but it's also perfect. This makes sense where we have this character, since it's like Ghostwatch as well in that. He points out flaws in what Christou does to set the stage. We then learn that about Carmichael and what he's done in the past as well. He then watches the presentation with June and Lily doing a demonstration of his own. It makes you think that what they did on stage was staged until he comes up with a way to prove wrong that doesn't work like he thought. Bliss has enough of being arrogant and angry that it worked so well. So let's go over to our duo then of June and Lily. The former is a doctor of parapsychology or something along these lines. She is the guardian of Lily since her family perished in the tragedy at the house during the ritual. June also has a connection to Jack. She doesn't want to do a demonstration, but she gets ambushed into it. Things start the chain of events that go off the rails. I thought this was good balancing as a scientist who does care for Lily. The better performance, though, is Torelli. She seems so sweet and innocent, but that changes on a dime to being creepy. She got under my skin the best way possible. Things that go down there also go back to Ghostwatch while doing its own thing as well. Where I'll go next on his filmmaking. Thought the editing was good here for splicing the footage that is shown on air during the commercial breaks going backstage. What is interesting there is that off air, that stuff is black and white. That helps to differentiate. Also, setting the stage with the documentary information was good. Having this be like a found footage film, or at least a variation, is good. This is more like a mockumentary. That makes it feel more real to me. That's not always easy to do when you have an actor like Dust Mulchin starring. Now, the effects, for the most part, are good. I did have some slight issues with the CGI. Since this is in the 70s, it feels like a throwback there. Not enough to ruin this, other than that. I thought that the sound design and the music was good as well. So let me finish out with some other things with the cast here. Bozzy was good to set up the stage with the supernatural. I like seeing him struggle with his psychic act, showing that he's a fraud. Then something supernatural happens with him, and it makes you wonder if it's real or not. There's Arturi, who is the co-host with Jack. What is intriguing there is he's religious, so the deeper we get into things, it upsets him. He tries to stop it. Tart is good as Leo Fisk, who is the producer that makes the show work. Other than that, I thought that Haig, Mustaskis, Seo, and the rest of the cast round the software was needed. I also didn't realize until writing my review, but Ironside as the narrator is great. So let me do a little bit of trivia then before I end up my thoughts. The Carmichael character is based, including physically, on the real-life James Randi. This was a talented magician who became a famous psychic debunker, and he started an institute that offered a large reward to anyone that could reproduce their supposed paranormal powers in controlled conditions. Over decades, nobody's been able to win the money. Horror fame novelist Stephen King gave praise this movie. He got a screener. It's absolutely brilliant. Couldn't take my eyes off it. Your results may vary, but as I say, but I urge you to watch it when you can. Dust Mulchin was cast in a lead role in the film's central character after the directors read an article about him being a regional horror TV host, which he had written for Fangoria magazine. Colin said in an interview with the film's two directors published in the magazine, well, I mean, other than sure just recognizing his awesome work and all the films that he's been in, but then he opened up Fango one day and read an article by him on regional horror hosts, and reading that and knowing his work, I thought this is going to be a really good fit. Obviously, our hero Jack is a TV host, so it felt like he would have some affinity there. The actual specific episode of the Don Lane show from 75, which inspired this horror movie, were those featuring Uri Geller and Dora Stokes. The horror movie's filmmakers, the Karn brothers, have said this picture and an official statement, in the 70s and 80s, there was something slightly dangerous about late-night TV. Talk shows in particular were a window in some strange adult world. We thought combining that charged, live-to-air atmosphere with the supernatural could be a uniquely frightening experience. That show that they were referring to, I guess the Australian newspaper, the Sydney Morning Herald, reported that the picture takes inspiration from American-born Don Lane and is pretty famous, I guess, late-night Australian talk show. I didn't know that. The name of the mysterious men at the club, situated in the California Redwoods as the Grove, is based on and inspired by the real-life Bohemian Grove located in Monte Rio, California. Though set in New York City, the film was shot in Dockland Studios in Australia. The amount of time that the opening black-and-white sequences run is about 8 minutes. It was inspired by the 80s shockumentary documentary The Killing of America. The later sequences in black-and-white in the movie were on-set and off-air interludes during commercial breaks. The movie takes place on Halloween It actually had two festival screenings on Halloween. Looks like Mumbai Film Festival and Brisbane International Film Festival. The Demon Mr. Wiggles is a neat nod to The Exorcist's Captain Howdy. The third theatrical feature film written and directed by Australian horror movie filmmakers the Carnes Brothers. Their first two were Scare Campaign and 100 Bloody Acres. Debut theatrical film of Torelli, who portrayed a satanic cult survivor. The Cutaways and We'll Be Right Back were made by AI. The name of the book, which the paranormal psychiatrist author Dr. June Ross Mitchell wrote, was Conversations with the Devil. And the name of the American late night show that was staged in New York City was Night Owls, a.k.a. Night Owls with Jack Delroy. And there's also something here with something that happens at the climax that is borrowed from The Night Evelyn Came Home Out of the Grave, which has to do with their movie poster. I'm not going to go into that because it could ruin things. But in conclusion, this is one that had hype surrounding it, and I thought it lived up to it. The best part here is the acting. Dasmalchian leads the way with Bliss, Torelli, and Gordon rounding this out with the important characters. The rest of the cast push them to where they end up. I thought this was unnerving. There's an added element with the variation on found footage. This is well made from the cinematography to the editing. My only issue is some minor things with the CGI. I'll recommend giving this one a watch. I'm excited to revisit this to see where it falls on my end of year list, because this has solely put itself, I mean not solely, but this is in my top five as of right now, so I'm kind of curious to see if it holds up. I don't think it'll have that much issue, but regardless. My rating here for Late Night with the Devil is going to be a 9 out of 10. Not going to do a spoiler section since this is so new, and I don't really think there's anything else I need to delve into here. So let me get you over to the trailer of my second featured review. Second featured review here is going to be Alita, the Queen of Mars. This is from 1924, directed by Yakov Protazanov. And then the screenplay was written by Alexei Fashko and Fyodor Otstep. And then it looks like that Alexei Tolstoy is the one that wrote the play I believe this is based from. This is starring Yulia Soltanezova, Igor Ilyinsky, and Nikolai Testorelty, while also featuring Nikolai Badalova, Vera Orlova, Valentina Kundinsky, Pavlov Pol, Konstantin Egger, Yuri Skadovsky, Alexandra Paragots, Sophie Lefatina, Varvara Mastilanova, Mikhail Sharova, Tamara Andilgim, Yosef Tolnakanov, Vladimir Urlalovsky, N. Tretyaknov, and Ivan Chuvalov. Now, if I'm mispronouncing those names, I do apologize. A little rusty on my Russian there. But this one, adventure, comedy, drama, family, fantasy, horror, romance, sci-fi, thriller. I don't know if they missed any of them there. This is a co-production between the Soviet Union, United Kingdom, and Australia. Currently sitting on a 6.4 on IMDb. And a 3.2 on Letterboxd with our synopsis being engineer Mitsilav Sergeyevich Las travels to Mars where he leads a popular uprising against a ruling group of elders with the support of Queen Alita, who has fallen in love with him after watching him through a telescope. So this is a movie that I didn't really know about until I was looking for horror from 1924 for Centennial Club. I didn't even realize until settling into watches that this is from the Soviet Union. Something I read was that this is their first crack at making an epic, and that intrigued me to see how this would work. So I'll do some featured notes on before I get into the movie, and I'll start with our director of Protonazanov. Now, he helmed 54 films and 6 shorts. This isn't considered horror on Letterboxd, so just keep that in mind going forward. They only have him doing one in genre with The Queen of Spades from 1916. There's an assistant director of David Morskoy. Now, he did 2 movies. This is the only one that I've seen. He has none other ones in horror. Over to our writers, first is Fashko. He wrote 3 films, only one that I've seen, and nothing else in horror. Ostep wrote 14 films, did 2 others in genre with The Queen of Spades, and then another version of that story from 1937. So the original writer of the play is Tolstoy, has credited with 19 films and 3 shorts, has one that is considered horror with Bloodsuckers. This is the only work that I've seen. Then let's go over to the cast. First is Soltanevsva. Now, she did 5 films. I've only ever seen this, nothing else in genre. Next is Ilyinsky. He has 24 movies and 3 shorts. I've only ever seen this one. He didn't do anything in horror. Then last is Terastelty. Now, they did 2 motion pictures. I've only ever seen this one. Nothing else was done in horror. So, let's get into this movie then here. We start in 1921. Radios around the world receive a weird transmission. We see the code trying to be cracked, and one of the people who does this is Mitsilava. He seems familiar, but he can't crack it either. Should say this person is being portrayed by Testarelti. And then now he has a friend of Eugeni Spirandinova. Now he wonders if this is from Mars. Now let me introduce others around this guy here. And that we have Mitsilava is married to Natasha, portrayed by Kundinsvi. Now she befriends Victor Ehrlich, who is portrayed by Pol. Now he works for the government. He has developed a crush on her, and they get close. There is also a soldier who is in the city to recover from his wounds of Gusev, portrayed by Badalov. He gets close to a nurse of Masha, portrayed by Orlova, and they end up getting married. Another story that this follows is on Mars. They did send that signal. They're led by Tuskub, portrayed by Egert. His daughter is Alita, and she is portrayed by Soltanezva. Now, her favorite servant is Ihashka, portrayed by Paragonets. That one is sent the transmission to Gol, portrayed by Sadavansky. Now, he is in love with Alita. He isn't supposed to reveal their telescope, but she sweet-talks him into letting her use it. It is there that she sees Mitsilav kissing his wife. She wants to be kissed like that. So then, there are moving parts here that lead different things together. Natasha is going to put on a play. Because Victor has a crush on her, he steals a bag of sugar to give to her. She must hide it, though. This starts an investigation into him, and this also leads then to, you know, her. Mitsilav doesn't like how close his wife has gotten to Victor, and this causes him to take an assignment where he is away for 6 months. This makes her sad. Then up on Mars, we learn that Tuskub and the other elders have slaves that live under the surface. Alita is also upset that she cannot use the telescope and wants to go to Earth. Her obsession causes her to fall in love with Mitsilav, despite never meeting. The transmission sent to Earth has Yevgeny developing a rocket to go to our neighboring planet as well. So let's leave my recap introduction of the characters. What I want to start is that knowing the history of film, Soviet Union around this time was starting to pump out propaganda like October, 10 Days That Shook the World, and Battleship Potemkin. Now, in the years that followed, there is commentary that is, you know, hidden in all of this, you know, talking about communism being good for the people. It's an interesting duality that we see with Mars as well. So I'm not sure if this makes the case as well as it thinks it wants to. It makes me wonder if the director did that on purpose. Part of the issue could be that we're looking at the Soviet Union post-World War I and right after the revolution. Gusev doesn't know what to do with himself now that he cannot fight. He says that he helped bring over 4 new countries to the USSR. He's proud of that. There is rationing of food. This could also be showing just life in the Soviet Union. Victor steals the sugar and then does what he can to cover it up. Mitsilav becomes jealous of his wife befriending this man as well. My issue there is that we have toxic masculinity. Instead of talking to her, he assumes and takes an assignment where he leaves her 6 months. By abandoning her, I don't blame her for having an affair like that. And I don't necessarily think she actually is, but that's what he thinks. She should just end her marriage, but she still loves him, and what he thinks is happening is only in his head. Life doesn't look easy here. Now, let's go over to life on Mars then. The moment that I heard that there were slaves under the surface, Mars is the United States or any capitalistic country. What is interesting there is that the U.S. was built on slavery. there are still aspects that we see as well, and I will just say for-profit prisons. It doesn't shock me either that later in this movie, Gusev and the others go to Mars. An uprising is led. This soldier is leery of Queen Alita being part of it for obvious reasons. I do agree with the workers revolting. I'm just not sure that communism is the answer, and I'll digress there. There isn't much more to discuss with the story, so let's go over to the acting. I thought that Solnetsva was good in her role as a titular character. What is interesting, though, is that we go away from her for long stretches. This film being as early as in the cinema as it is, as this doesn't know how to kind of balance these stories, and I'll come back to this, though. Tolesti is solid in his role. There was a reveal that I didn't see coming, and it makes sense now. He's our true lead, in my opinion. Now, he is good as well as... he's good at that. I'd also say that Batalava, Orlova, Kundensky, Pol, and the others in the village in Soviet Union were also good. And then I'll also say that Eggert, Sadovatsky, and all those on Mars are solid for what was needed as... for that little section as well. All that's left in is filmmaking. What I'll say there is that I love the sets. They don't necessarily look real, but I like what they're trying to do. There is some charm. I love the duality of seeing this apartment, laboratory, and other places around this village. Having the contrast with the futuristic look on Mars was good. Cinematography was limited by technology. I had no issues there, though, either. I thought it was shot well, and the framing is pretty good. My biggest problem, though, is this is just too long. We lingered a bit too much, but I also contribute that to, you know, being when it was made. Other than that, I don't know if the soundtrack was synced to this, was the original. It did work for what they needed, though, so I will give them credit for that. And look at some trivia on the IMDb page. This movie became such a hit in the Soviet Union that many new parents named their little girls Alita. This was director Protazanov's first film after returning to the Soviet Union from his exile in Paris. At the International Exhibition of Decorative Arts 1925 Paris Expo, the director was given an award for this film. Letnia's debut, Soltanevza's debut, the Finnish band Cleaning Woman tours playing music on clothes horses to the film. That's kind of a weird little thing there, but I digress. But in conclusion, I'm glad that I can take this off my list. This is an interesting look at the life of the Soviet Union, coupled with propaganda about how they could help Mars overcome the tyranny of the ruling elders. They're the opposite side of the same coin as the U.S. This was made well enough for the time. I love what they do with the look of the future society on Mars. The acting was solid. My biggest gripe here is this runs too long, and it doesn't balance the stories well enough. This one I would recommend to fans of the history of cinema. Light on the horror elements, but it doesn't shock me, though, either. This feels in the vein of something like Metropolis. I think this would make a good double feature there. So my rating for Alita, the Queen of Mars, is going to be a 7 out of 10. Once again, not going to do a spoiler section. I don't think I need to delve into anything deeper than what I've already given to you. So let me get you over to one last break before I close out the show. And welcome back one last time here. And just to kind of go through my social medias and stuff, if you'd like to send me an email, you can send that at journeywithacinephile@gmail.com. You can send me any sort of feedback, or if you have any questions or anything, go ahead and shoot them there, and I'll get back to you as soon as I can. Or if you want to send me any screener links or anything like that, anything podcast-related, you can send it via that way. If you'd like to read any of the written reviews, I'll direct you to Reviews of the Dead, and that's horrorreview.webnode.com. If you'd like to become friends with me on Facebook, I'm David Michigan Garrett Jr. On Twitter, I'm Buckeye from Mish. Letterboxd, I'm David OSU. On Instagram, I'm DavidOSU87. On Threads, I'm DavidOSU87. And then Journey with a Cinephile has its own Instagram at Journey with a Cinephile, all one word. Now, all of these ones I will be sharing, like, my ratings on, whatnot. I know for Letterboxd, all of the reviews are going to be for horror and non-horror alike. Instagram I will be sharing over there is my different, like, posters and everything for things that I'm reviewing. My personal account, you might see some personal pictures every now and then if I can remember to take them. And then, you know, kind of same thing for Threads. And then Journey with a Cinephile is going to be more of just kind of posting podcast-related different stuff over there. And I'll also direct you to the Nightclub Discord channel, as I have a little section over there where we have some good conversations. I post all of my reviews and any new podcast episodes or some of the things I'm watching when I actually have time to post that. So keep an eye out over there, and I'll have the link for that and everything else in the show notes there. And then I'm also going to direct you, if a way that you can actually listen to the show is going to be through the PodNation TV. This is a streaming service and everything like that. There will be a link in the blog posts for all of my episodes, so if you'd like to listen to it that way. It's kind of a cool little thing. You can definitely do that through like Roku TV, and there's some other apps for it as well, just as another way for you to consume this podcast if you decide to. There's also a lot of other great shows that are on that network as well. And for my next episode is going to be moving finally into my foray through the Force. And the first one that's going to be is a movie, of course, from 1934 of Maniac. I've seen this poster a lot, so I'm kind of intrigued to check that one out. And then I'm going to be going to the Gateway Film Center sometime this weekend to watch Exuma. This one looks kind of interesting. I believe it's South Korean. I know it is Asian, but I would have to double check the country of origin. And then I also have my foray through the Force rewatch is going to be The Living Dead at Manchester Morgue. I've already started watching Onibaba when I got home from the movies last night, so that'll be a mini review there. And then I'm also going to try to go back to watch Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. I know I said that last time. Life just got a little bit hectic, so I will try to get that one fit in here this week. So I don't think there's anything else I need to get you up to speed with here then for this outro. So I will say is whatever you do today, hope you're safe and doing, have a great time out there. This is your tour guide of David Garrett Jr., and I am signing off.
It had been a wonderful evening, and what I needed now to give it the perfect ending.